Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show, every second Saturday afternoon, 4 to 6 Eastern Time. My name's Christopher Holmes. I'm in Ottawa, Canada. I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist with a wide background in esoteric studies, studies of the secret doctrine, the psychology of consciousness, creation physics, and science. So we explore those areas as well as talking about the world situation and the problems faced at this time on the planet by humanity, the crises, I would say, that humankind is in. Okay, so usually I've been having guests for the last months, but today I'm just Jim and I are going to host the show together, and we're going to open up the phone lines, but not for half an hour, and then we'll open them up in the half hour, and I'll give the number out at that time if anyone would like to call in and any comments or questions or whatever. Okay, hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, this is James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Jim and I have been friends through our life since high school and explored esotericism together and shared a lot of interests in our science and philosophy studies. How are you, Jim? I'll give it over to you. Anything you'd like to start with there? Comments or suggestions? We're going to try something different this time. We're going to have a show and open up the lines. We haven't done that for quite a while.
Yeah, that would be really nice if somebody actually phones in and has something to say or has a question or a comment. That would be really good, actually.
Yeah, I meant to send forward an email to you from John Francis,
Okay.
who emailed me after our show last week.
Oh.
And I emailed him back and mentioned to him that if he was available, it'd be nice to hear from him.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah. One time when you were, I can't remember if you were. I'm uncertain. You might have been in New Zealand and couldn't do the show, or it might have been that you had something. You were still here. But anyway, I did a program on Gurdjieff, and I did sort of an introduction to sort of a biographical sketch of him and talked about the early part of his career. I never actually came back to sort of, you know, continue on that, but John actually phoned in and had a couple of comments and questions, which was really nice, actually.
Yeah.
Nice to know that somebody's out there is listening.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading, I finished reading through again your book on divine mysteries and...
or God, science.
God, science and the secret doctrine, yeah. And I was really struck by, you had some interesting quotes from a book about a 20-year-old book by Nick Herbert on quantum reality, which was really interesting, and just the whole... commentaries on the idea of non-locality and how, you know, incredibly peculiar this is, but how it's essential to understand this in terms of modern physics. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, you know, that really the holographic paradigm is, I think, is a really significant development not only in modern science, but in trying to integrate modern science with esoteric spirituality and with the esoteric studies of consciousness. And in your work, that you bring this together in a variety of very interesting ways. But how it's, in a way, too, the holographic paradigm was anticipated and has been described, and various aspects have been described by mystics throughout the ages. But it's interesting how modern physics has come to these views, which in a way really provide another level of evidence and another whole realm of evidence, which suggests that somehow everything, all of the parts are contained within the whole, and the whole is contained within all of the parts on all levels of creation. This is such an extraordinarily difficult idea in a way to wrap your head around, but it really. It's really so essential. It's like it's such an important idea, I think, that you know, that's really missing. And 30 years ago, when we Ken Wilber came out with a book, The Holographic Paradigm and Other Paradoxes, discussing this idea with people like David Bohm and Marilyn Ferguson and Renee Weber and various commentators, that the idea hasn't really caught on, and the paradigm hasn't developed to, I think, in the way that we both thought it would, and I find that interesting that it hasn't. And again, as I say, I think it's such an important path to explore, and I think it really is a critical element of sort of forging a new metaphor, like, you know, under the rise of Newtonian mechanics, like the world was viewed as the universe was viewed as a great machine, like the clockwork universe. Everything was a mechanism, and everything ran in terms of mechanical principles. But now we know that that's just like that metaphor applies on a certain level of reality, but it breaks down as you approach the speed of light, or as things get very, very small. So it's good for matter on a certain level and at a certain speed, but it doesn't really describe the universe in its totality. And yet the other side of it is that there has to be something that can supplant that. And I think really the holographic paradigm is in some essential way, it's an answer to that.
Yeah, it's interesting because the holographic paradigm is absolutely implicit to an esoteric perspective, in that, like in the Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky says the fundamental dogma of occultism is the kind of undivided wholeness and unity of everything. And she says at one point that there is one omniscience, which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. So it's like the idea of there being God or some divine being, some higher dimensional being who's kind of conscious all through space, and the intelligence of the whole then is latent everywhere within the whole. So the very idea of God being omniscience kind of implies the wholeness within any part. So that's kind of like a fundamental dogma of occultism, and Gurdjieff would call it an idea of higher knowledge, if we could understand it. And that's a lot of mystical experiences involve experiencing kind of unity and merging with different aspects of the cosmos on different levels that show our ability to kind of have these states of unitive consciousness. So that striving for unity is so important. So the holographic paradigm is kind of implicit to a mystical perspective. And then, as you were saying, like it didn't develop very well in Western psychology. And I think that relates a lot to the influence of Carl Priebram, who I quote him from that Omni interview where he says, well, there are no laser beams in the mind. And that he explains that the holographic paradigm developed because they could apply the same forms of mathematics to analyze psychological data as are used to break down wave fronts. Like it's called Fourier analysis. So everything seemed to be working on the kind of wave analysis applied to everything. But he didn't think that there was actually a laser beam in the mind. And that's what I realized is so unique in mystical esoteric teachings, is this idea is that there is some form of self-illuminating element within within the human heart, or actually within the higher dimensions of the human heart. And that's named in different traditions, like a Kabbalist or in Judaism, they might be called divine sparks or sparks of holiness. And that's used, divine sparks, in Sufism. And Blavatsky refers to a monad. And in yogic teachings, it's the jiva atma within the heart. So there's some self-illuminating element within the heart, and that illumination of that element somehow is consciousness, because consciousness is actually some form of light, interior light. Like there's consciousness in the inner world, which allows us to be aware of objects of experience. So the idea in mysticism is that, lo and behold, there actually is, in a way, a laser point of light established within the human heart. And this is the means by which the human holographic experiences is produced. So there, see, whereas in the modern Western psychology view of the holographic paradigm, no one actually ever considered that there's a point source of coherent light established within the higher dimensional physics of the human heart, that there's like a God spark, and that consciousness somehow derives from the illumination of this element within us. So if you have a mystical perspective, it's then a whole new idea, like, well, holography, how might, you know, it's a whole new way of approaching how a human being might be a part of the whole, or work on holographic principles.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a variety of reasons why this hasn't probably developed that much. I mean, in a way, like, I mean, it's not surprising in a sense, because, I mean, most of the discussion, I think, tended to be mostly on the physical side, and David Bohm was very influential in putting forward this perspective with regard to physics. But as you say, Prebrum developed it sort of independently with, and was able to describe certain neural processes that he thought conformed to the mathematics worked in terms of describing them, Fourier transforms, which is applied to holography, seemed applicable to neural processes, and I think he really did believe that the idea of somehow that memory, which was what he had been studying, it was somehow distributed throughout the brain, and it wasn't localized in any one specific spot. And I think he did buy into that. But I don't think I think in a sense, in psychology, it would be such a huge leap from the way academic psychology is practiced today to come to this kind of viewpoint, because it's such a radically different model of everything, really. Like the implications of it are so staggering that it really undoes, in a way, a lot of modern psychology, in the sense that the discussion is really with regard to consciousness, and it's with regard to consciousness in a way which is really quite alien to the way that most Western psychologists and philosophers discuss consciousness.
Mainly, you know, they because they equate it with the functions of the mind in the head. They equate consciousness with kind of thinking and your kind of normal egoic level of kind of thinking and mind and personality processes.
And they think of it in terms of, you know, biochemical processes, and it's very much a mechanistic model, and it's very much a reductionist approach to studying consciousness. But it's also, like you say, the site and location of it is assumed to be in the head brain.
Yeah,
which is critical. Like, and it's sort of, as we've talked about before, but it's like, if you read most psychologists talking about consciousness and most modern philosophers, you would think that we were just all these things, these lumps that walk around directed by our heads, like that, you know, that somehow, like, the rest of our bodies don't count. It's very peculiar how, like, psychologists are truly head cases and don't go beyond that.
They think mainly of us as having a mind and the body, and kind of a dual nature, the psyche and the soma. I'm just missing something I wanted to say in response to what you said, but I've lost it.
I think actually we're going to, when I started saying that sort of a mechanistic and
that was it. because I was realizing also that, like, the mystical occult teachings also have a mechanism. Like, it's mechanistic science. Like, in a way, like, there's an occult mechanism. Also, like, it's not like the occult or esoteric ideas about the self and the heart. Like, there is a mechanism, what they're saying, like, how it's elaborated. You know, the presence of self helps to bring life into the heart and generate the heartbeat through the SA node and the interior electrical system of the heart. Like, that's a mystery in science, which occultists would say, well, that's because there's a higher dimensional physics to the heart. That's where the life entity is, the living entity, that there's a living entity in the body. And that life comes from life, and that life from that living entity then spreads through the body, and it's connected to the blood and to the breath. So the whole idea of how the blood and breath, that's how the human body is ensouled. And this distinction is very important between body, soul, and spirit. Because, like, we have a spiritual body and we have a physical body. And between them, in a way, we have the soul. Because the idea is that the spirit ensouls the body. So there's a distinction between body, soul, and spirit, which is really important. Because that has to do with the zero point dynamics. Because we're ensouled through the zero point dynamics. And the spiritual aspect of life is in the higher dimensional planes, and the body is in the lower dimensional planes, and the soul is kind of the bridge between the spirit and the body. So human beings ensouled through the heart. So, but I was trying to say that in occultism also, there is a mechanism. Like, if you go into the occult teachings and kind of discern what is being taught, as I've attempted to do, and bring it together, you see that, oh, this is a coherent set of ideas. You know, there's a self-illuminating self within the heart. And then how it's described, the bliss sheath, the size of a small grape of unemergent light. Okay, well, there you have, you know, that's the basis of the human holographic experience, because there's this source of unemergent light which serves as a referent beam for the creation of the holographic images and holographic life. So, yeah, it's a whole new, to have a mystical perspective on the holographic paradigm. I've not seen anyone in the mainstream literature try to articulate this. Have you ever seen anyone attempt that, Jim, or other than in my own work?
Not certainly not to the extent. I mean, to touch on it, like they say, Ken Wilber, you know, is wrote that book or edited that book, but and is certainly conversant with all the different esoteric and mystical traditions. But it's funny, like how he hasn't sort of developed anything along those lines, or hasn't really explored it, you know. And I don't really know of anybody that, I mean, I think people sort of touch on things maybe a little bit indirectly. I'm trying to think of what, it's been a long time since I read Talbot, and I don't think he sort of touches on things, but I'm trying to think of somebody else that maybe, but I guess the answer.
Yeah, I've not seen it anyway.
Short answer is no, I guess.
Yeah. I've been reading Laszlo lately.
Oh, yeah.
I've been reading Laszlo's Science and the Akashic Field.
Yeah.
Yeah, and oddly written book.
Yeah.
Have you ever read that?
Oh, I gave it to you. I've read Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos. Science,
oh, that's one you gave me. We talked about that.
Science and the Akashic Field, and I have another one. I mean, he has a lot of really interesting things to say, but it's like, it's sort of peculiar in some ways too. Like, he doesn't.
Yeah, that's
really,
what I found.
Doesn't really develop, but you know, I like what he says about certain aspects about what he says about the Akashic Field. I think are really interesting. One of his ideas is that the universe is kind of recreating itself and it's remembering its previous attempts.
And
so, like, that's very interesting to me. Like,
yeah.
as a alternative kind of to the multiverse idea, like, you know, the one of the reasons why everything's so finely tuned is that there are just an infinite number of universes, and this just happens to be the one where these things worked out this way. He says that the idea is that the universe creates itself, but it goes in cycles, but it remembers its previous attempts, and so it gets smarter. And the example he gives is how many attempts it would take to do Rubik's Cube.
If you had no feedback.
If you had no feedback,
yeah.
And
it's like a billion years.
And then if you're given feedback, it's 2 minutes.
Yeah,
a blind person trying to do a Rubik's Cube with zero feedback, it would take forever, basically.
Yeah.
But if you're given feedback, it takes 2 minutes, which is amazing. Like, I mean, you know, it just shows you how information and memory are so important, or they're so integral to everything. And in a way, like, you see that throughout nature. You see that in our own physical bodies, you know. One of the things that's so missing, I've been reading quite a bit of like alternative interpretations of biology and biology, which recognizes the importance of consciousness. And you see how, again, the mechanistic model is very useful in describing biology on a certain level, but it's not really the whole story. And there's so much that's not explained. Most importantly, what is the nature of life? You know,
yeah.
A small problem when you're studying biology.
But you need
this perspective. What I was just going to say is, like, okay, psychologists study consciousness in the head and the brain, and that it directs everything that happens in the body. But it's not that simple. It's much, much more complex than that, and it really grossly oversimplifies the amazing complexity of our own physical being. Like, when you really begin to study it and think about it, it's like we're enormously complex. And you can on some level describe things and say, oh, well, you know, this is an explanation of it. But it's a description, but it's not an explanation. And you have to deal eventually with the two main problems, which are life and consciousness.
Yeah.
What is the nature of life, and what is the nature of consciousness?
How does
life come from non-life, and how does consciousness come from non-consciousness?
Yeah.
To me, that's ridiculous.
It's funny. It's so interesting. Like, these two fundamental enigmas in science are exactly the place where what the mystics have said is becomes relevant when you come to those. What is the nature of life? Is there a living entity within the body? And what is the nature of human consciousness? Is it produced by physical processes, like neurological processes? Or is it due to the existence of this higher dimensional entity that has the certain properties, including that of light, being self-illuminating like the sun, is how mystics describe the self in the heart. So, I mean, in modern psychology, no one ever even thinks that, could we really have an I, like a real singular I? You know, it's like no one even thinks of that as a possibility.
Again, it's very interesting when you think about that, is that, you know, what is the nature of I? And it's like, again, it's one of the most fundamental questions, but there really isn't very much in modern psychology that really addresses it. Nobody ever, like you say, ever takes seriously the idea that we might have a real I, or that I could be something that's related to higher dimensional realities. Again, you know, it's like 20th century psychology is stuck in 19th century physics, you know, or 18th century physics. It's like it's so far behind the times. I mean, it's interesting in the whole nature of the development of 20th century physics. You have all of these people coming to, all of these most prominent physicists coming to these ideas about the sort of the mindfulness of the universe, like the Sir James Jeans thing that, you know, the more we study it, the more the universe appears to be more like a great thought than a great machine, you know, rather than the Newtonian clockwork universe. It all looks like it's a big thought of some sort of intelligence, or Sir Arthur Eddington saying that, you know, that the stuff of the universe is mind stuff, and or that, you know, physics reveals a shadow world of symbols, and beyond that there's some sort of reality which physics can't really reach and can't really describe, but which perhaps the mystics have actually touched on. So I mean, and there's all sorts of Eugene Wigner saying that you can't understand quantum mechanics without understanding consciousness, and you know, almost every major physicist of the 20th century. But it's like the whole of 20th century psychology is like none of that exists. Like, you know,
yeah, I mean, they don't have an understanding. They're so busy
trying to be scientists that they're trying to be scientists like from the 18th or 17th or 19th century. You know, it's very peculiar. I wanted to just say one thing about what you said about soul and spirit, which I think is interesting, because traditionally, like in the mystical paths, you have often a description of the three-part journey, which is from in the development of consciousness, which is from sense, which is our normal waking consciousness, to soul, which is a higher level of development of consciousness, to spirit. So, you know, that's sort of the reversal of the idea that spirit informs soul, informs sense, you know. So that's the kind of return to where we, you know, we began.
Well, I would say that's like what you're describing is the evolutionary process, because the spirit, I would say, ensouls the body, and so the spirit comes into the body, but then we, over time, we lose our self-remembrance, and we kind of become so conditioned by the sense. And then we have to kind of struggle to attain the soul again, and then to attain the spirit again.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the evolutionary current rather than the involutionary current.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Plato said that truth is no forgetting, which is essentially is that we remember from whence we came, you know. That's when we become sewn into the instrument of time, I think is Plato's phrase.
I
love that. We become identified with the egoistic structure of the psyche and with our sense-based reality, and we take that as who we are, and that's how our I experience is defined through our senses and through our ego structure. And we forget that our roots are the higher dimensional spaces, and we forget how we've devolved or involved from these higher sources. You know, we forget the spark within us, the spirit within us. And, you know, there's all sorts of beautiful, explanations and descriptions of how we get tied up in knots in our heart, hey? Like the process of identification through the senses, the emotional identification are these knots, and that's how why we aren't aware of that spark that within us, that we aren't aware of the true nature of the heart, hey? So we become bound with the lower plane, which is all mediated through the senses and through the ego structures.
It's actually very beautiful. That consciousness of that, though, passes into the subconscious. That's interesting in Gurdjieff. Like, Gurdjieff says, like, people don't have a real consciousness. Like, your real consciousness is passed into your subconsciousness, you know? And so we have to recover that consciousness of the heart. Because I think when we form, even as a fetus in the womb, like, the heart is the first that grows, and you see that, and if you see a baby in the womb, you see the highlight of the heart. That's where life grows, from the heart in the womb. So I think from our very first experience growing as a biological being, it's kind of growth from the heart. I've always felt that the gleefulness of babies often is because it's still in their bliss sheath.
Their bliss sheath, yeah.
Yeah, like the kind of innocence and purity of it, and the delight in things. So, but then that is lost through experiences, through life and conditioning and people, So that experience, so it's passes into the subconscious. So what we have to do is kind of like recover this lost consciousness within ourselves.
Yeah.
And you see it, that's what the mystics have said all through the ages. They say, know thyself.
Yeah.
You know? and people don't really, they think that self is like your personality and your ego, but no, what mystics are saying is that the essential self is something like totally different.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because I think that's really true, you know. And my next door neighbors have a 15-month-old, and every day when I come home from work in the evening, they're usually having dinner by that point, and the baby is sitting, and I can see right into their kitchen because the kitchen table's right beside the window beside my driveway. And this baby is like amazingly intent, you know, just like very conscious looking being to me, you know, and will just like laugh, like, you know, and smile.
Yeah.
And every day I come home after spending all day with all these serious human beings, and I look at that baby and I think, you know, I want to be more like that baby than the people that I'm with at work. But I mean, it's so evident in the baby's face, you know, at times. It's like you say, I think, you know, like they're still in their bliss sheath on a certain level that is lost, and they get filled up with.
I think that's like the Christian teaching where Christ says, unless you become babes, even.
Yeah.
You cannot enter into the kingdom of God. Isn't that what it says?
Become
as little children. Yeah. So it's like getting back into that kind of inherent blissfulness and joyousness of the heart and purity of the heart.
You get that description with some of the yogis and some of the more evolved beings, is that they're just sort of sitting there smiling, you know, and I think it was Ramakrishna was the guru who, you know, he was kind of a basket case in a sense. Like, I mean, he was this great, you know, guru and teacher, but every once in a while he'd just get so blissed out he'd sort of fall over, you know, and all his followers have to come and sort of pick him up, you know.
It's
really quite amazing. You know,
yeah.
Like, I mean, he was really, really out there, but, you know, like, he had this great aura around him and, you know, people knew that he had develop this higher state of consciousness, but he would go into these sort of ecstatic states all the time and you know, just sort of be blissed out beyond.
Yeah, you can kind of see that in certain yogis. I think of Yogananda, and you look at pictures of him, and he's like this holy smokes kind of beautiful saint. It's like he has an aura about him, you know, there's just something different about him, you know.
I saw that. I just got this.
See that.
I just got this book, which was put together a few years ago by one of his pupils' conversations with Yogananda. I just got it last week, and there are pictures of him, and he's just like such a beautiful human being. Like, I mean, he's really one of my favorites, and just, I mean, in terms of somebody who had a huge heart, great heart, you know, it really comes through his autobiography. But, yeah, you just look at him and you kind of know that this guy was, you know, there was something very special about him. I want to ask you a question. Do you recognize this? I just read this something to you. This is an introduction to something. This age in which the tide of ignorance, darkness, and other mechanical forces has carried human beings to the very brink of not only their own destruction but that of the planet itself, solemnly attest to the fact that the waking consciousness of almost all men and women is a veritable sleep, and making conscious and underlines the necessity of serious individuals making conscious efforts to awaken.
I recognize it a bit, but I don't remember who it's from.
It's from the proposed charter of the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science in the summer of 1984, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really? Wow, that's pretty good. That's good. Oh, I meant to, I hope, yeah, hold on to anything you have, documentation of earlier things.
I don't know
if you have any of my old York letters and things, because all my things were burnt in the fire.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't have things like that anymore.
When I come up on, I dug through, I was amazed I found this, I dug through this thing, because I wrote this, like, basically I wrote most of this, I think, in 1984. I mean, we worked on it together, but... I mean, I'm just reading this, and it actually stands up pretty well. The essence of the human condition and the possibilities of its transformation suggested by this ancient science are radically different from that quote-unquote understanding which so-called learned people acquire today through modern education. Furthermore, from the perspective of the ancient tradition, modern science is hopelessly limited in its scope and validity as long as it fails to acknowledge the importance of self-study and the significance of consciousness and spirit.
Yeah, that was part of it?
Yeah.
Too. Oh, yeah. Oh, I, you just reminded me, Jim, I did want to mention, I'm going to delay opening up here.
Oh.
From the 21st. I'd said that I was going to have an open house on the 21st.
Yeah.
Yeah, because getting copies of, I have the proofs copy of my Heart Doctrine book in the mail at the moment. And I should get it next week, but I really wanted to have copies of that and have kind of a book release when I opened the Institute. So I'm going to put it off. I thought April 1st, April Fool's Day, that would be fun. But I think even a little bit further, I'm going to just keep working and leave it for a while. So I'm very excited about getting copies of a proof copy of The Heart Doctrine next week. It's going to be nice seeing it in trade paperback format.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah.
And I'm working away still at revising God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which I was going to talk about that a little bit. But I thought maybe what we should do is we should open it up in case anyone wants to call in. And I'll give the call-in number here, which is 888-815-9756, and that's good in North America, at least Canada and the U.S. and some other countries, I think the U.K., and if otherwise you'd need to go to the BBS site if you're from another country, and there are some other telephone numbers there. Okay, so we'll just leave it open, Jim, in case anyone wants to call in.
Yeah, okay. You might just mention the website, your website,
my website is www.zeropoint.ca. Oh, I had an interesting email from a lady this morning, Jim, who wrote and said that she had been having amazing coincidences involving the number 137. And she sent me the link to one of the coast-to-coast bits that I did where I talked about the one principle of 1, 3, and 7. So I invited her to call in today, but I don't think she would have got it.
Oh, yeah.
But that would be interesting because it's amazing at certain times how certain number coincidences, like when I have certain periods where the numbers 137 just kind of reappear in everything. You know, I'll buy groceries and it'll be 3017 or, you know, in numbers and it comes up in different ways. And I was just reading, it was funny, she emailed me about that today because I've been reading a new book by Leonard Susskind called The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. And he just has a part in here. He's talking about the fine or the constants in nature and how finely attuned they are to allow for life. And there's like a whole group of fundamental constants which can't be explained from first principles but are just established as constants. And the first one that is symbolized by the letter alpha, okay, so this is the alpha constant, and what it is the fine structure constant, and it is approximately the fraction of 1 divided by 137. And that is called the coupling constant in physics. And partly it relates to the kind of strength of the different fundamental forces. And at one point he says, only one lucky electron out of 137 emits a photon. He gives it, that's one line from him.
Wow.
But it was funny just coming across that, the significance of that number again. It's such an amazing, this whole idea of the 1, the 3, and the 7. And one thing that has just struck me this last week in revising A God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. I've been developing the section on the what Blavatsky calls the Daihan Chohan, which means like the spiritual intelligences or divine intelligences. And in the Secret Doctrine, like before creation happens, there are seven luminous lords, but they're all latent in non-being. And then when creation happens, the first to emerge are the seven divine intelligences. And then their intelligence, that manifests, that manifests, that pattern, that sevenfoldness is manifest on different scales in nature. So the same pattern is reiterated through different generations. So, like the seven luminous lords are the first to be born from the nothingness. They're the divine intelligences that fashion the universe. But then on another level, you can have the seven lords of this in the sun, like within our solar system. And there you have seven luminous lords. So that pattern of the sevenfoldness is repeated. And so Blavatsky uses the word Daihan Chohan. That's her term for these spiritual or divine intelligences. And she uses the term in a generic sense a bit. Like it's not simply the firstborn seven luminous lords, but it's also the intelligences that fashion any cosmos on any order of scale. And it's fascinating, in the Secret Doctrine, what I came upon is where she talks about the Daihan Chohan at one point, and she symbolizes them with the Star of David, with the central point. And it's so amazing because the Star of David with the central point, like I just continually am like awed by the significance of that symbol. And to reiterate things I've said before, like an upward turn triangle represents the element fire, and the downward turn triangle represents the element water. Now, in the book of Genesis, in the beginning, the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved across the face of the water. So in that verse, the Spirit of God is fire, moved across the face of the water. So you have that basic mystical idea of these two primary elements, the fire and the water. The Spirit and Spirit and matter would be a parallel on a lower level. So if you take the symbol for fire and you take the symbol for water and you overlap them, and you got 6 points, and that's the Star of David or the Seal of Solomon. It's also the yogic symbol for the heart chakra. But the especially significant is to put a seventh central point within the Star of David. And for Blavatsky, in the Star of David, she puts a little Egyptian ankh, because the ankh in Egyptian symbolism is the life principle. So it's like the living entity is then kind of bounded by the fire and spirit. So the Star of David has, in a way, you could say it's a one, like the whole symbol is a one as a whole, or you could take the 0 point center as a one, and then there's a three, because you have the upward turn triangle and the downward turn triangle are three. Or you could also say it has three elements to it, because it's got the upward turn triangle, the downward turn triangle, and the zero, the point. So it has a threefold nature. And then if you add up all the vertices and the central point, you've got seven. So the Star of David with the central point depicts this pattern of 1-3-7 creation, which is just so profound. It's hard to convey to people the significance of these principles. I guess we've studied them, attempt to study these ideas for 30 years or something, so it's amazing the kind of sense, it's amazing how understanding of these principles develops. I've found that through my life.
Do you know that the if you add up the value of the Hebrew letters in the word Kabbalah, do you know what it adds up to?
22?
137.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. I was just looking at this online.
Wow.
And they're talking about what you were just talking about 1 over alpha. And Pauli was trying to understand today, and there's a book about Pauli, and you know, Pauli and Wolfgang Pauli and Jung wrote the book about synchronicity together, eh?
Yeah.
And Pauli, listen to this, Pauli was defeated in his efforts to get to the bottom of 1 over alpha, took it as a bad omen that he was assigned room 137 when he entered Zurich's Red Cross Hospital in December of 1958. He died 10 days later. Whereas Pauli,
yeah, that was from David Peet's book called Synchronicity, the Bridge Between Mind and Matter. I used to quote that in my book. When Pauli went to the hospital and he was given room 137, he said he thought he knew that was the end for him.
Well, I knew that I knew that Eddington was obsessed with a number two, and and it says here, in fundamental theory, Eddington lists 7 basic constants of physics, including an 80-digit integer. After eliminating 3 of the constants through a choice of units, Eddington settles on and this number as one of the constants of nature. He then carries out a program in which all 4 constants are obtained by purely theoretical calculation. In particular, Eddington believed he could prove that 1 over alpha is exactly 137.
Hold on a sec, Jim. I think we may have had someone come in. Did we have a guest on? Had someone called in? Okay, I guess not, Jim. I heard a beep at one point.
Too, yeah. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway.
Oh, yeah, so 1 over alpha.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly 137.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he,
it's amazing. It's a mystery number.
Yeah.
I read this earlier,
I didn't realize what the number was, but I knew he was obsessed with it. But,
isn't that funny? It's the first alpha. Like, it's the first number.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And that there's that first principle that I'm saying is the basic principle of mystical creation is this principle of the 1 divided by 3 in yield 7. Is that pattern of creation. And there it is, the fundamental alpha construct of modern physics. Wow, that's really interesting. That's funny. A remarkable coincidence for Pauli and Jung.
Yeah. Very interesting, actually. Yeah.
And then you go to, like this, you know, another neat example of the 137 pattern is a menorah. Are you familiar with like the Hebrew candlestick?
Yeah.
Because a traditional one has 3 feet,
right,
and it has 7 candles.
7 candles, yeah.
Yeah. So there again, the same pattern of the 3 and the 7.
The 1 holds the 3 and the 7. Yeah.
And the other amazing example of it is how it's all depicted in the Kabbalistic tree of life.
Yeah.
Where you have the supernal triad, and they're considered in the upper sphere. Above the abyss, and then you have 7 sephira created below. So you have the 3, as Blavatsky says, the 3 emanate the other 7.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you have that same principle of mystical creation, how the 1 becomes 3 and then 7.
Yeah, I was reading this, book, which is a compilation of Blavatsky's writings, mainly from The Secret Doctrine, but also from Isis Unveiled and some of her other work. And I was reading that there's a chapter called Microcosm, Macrocosm, and he was talking about the sources of her ideas about the sevenfoldness of things.
Oh, yeah.
and saying that realistically, you know, like a lot of her material is supposed to be derived or parallels from esoteric Buddhism, but this guy was saying that the seven doesn't appear in esoteric Buddhism, and to the extent that it does in Kabbalah, and that it's much more likely that, you know, that she was, I mean, and she speaks openly about, you know, the Tree of Life and Kabbalistic teachings, but he said, you know, it's really, that's where the strongest source of the septenary nature of everything is outlined and detailed. And he actually goes into a very similar description, like just what you were talking about in the Tree of Life, about the supernal triangle and then the seven below, which gives you the 10 levels of the Tree of Life. Very interesting how...
It's funny, though, just to, before we pass that, like... I would question what he's, well, Blavatsky draws profoundly from Kabbalah, but also the secret doctrine, though, is based on these stanzas of Zen, which are claimed to be of esoteric Tibetan Buddhist origin. So, I mean, the stanzas are actually there. So that is, she's drawing on the stanzas in the secret of doctrine. I mean, you can see she draws from Kabbalah at different points. But I mean, it's got no significance in the book relative to the stanzas of Zen. And what Blavatsky says about the stanzas of Zen, she traces their origin back to Atlantis, and she says before Atlantis, the stanzas were passed down from solar beings to earlier humans who existed on higher planes. So she's saying it's like this higher dimensional teaching that's been passed down, and that it's the perennial wisdom. It's like the root teaching of all the different traditions. So, I mean, I know in her book, though, her use of Kabbalah at times is very profound.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because she's talking at one point, too, about, and I couldn't really quite figure out exactly what she was saying, but sort of saying something, I think, to the effect that this higher being existed, which was sort of the source of other higher beings who had come at various times, like, you know, like kind of like Gurdjieff talks about the holy messengers that have come from time to time and incarnated and come to the earth. She was talking about sort of this archetype of higher beings that exists in some, I don't know what level of existence, but, and that this was sort of the template or the source of all of these manifestations that had come throughout human history. Very peculiar, but in a sense, like what she's saying is kind of like, it's a really profound idea. I mean, if it's true, you know, like, I mean, the idea that there are, you know, like that there are, avatars who come from time to time and who are direct sort of in, you know, incarnations of these higher, they're not even beings that developed and became, you know, higher conscious beings. They're direct incarnations, like, well, Jesus could be one, and
Zoroaster and
Zoroaster, yeah, it's like,
Krishna, and
or Ashiyada Shamash in Gurdjieff's, I mean, who's, I
sacred
guess,
sacred messengers,
sacred messengers. I mean, it's
Muhammad.
Very, when you start thinking about, you know, about this idea, like, you get the idea of these higher realms is existing and of their importance in informing everything that happens in the material world and in the world that we think we know and understand through our senses and through our intellect and through our normal waking consciousness. The idea that these levels exist above us in terms of higher, that they're higher levels of greater consciousness and being is such a profound idea. And I mean, it really begins to provide a perspective in which you can try to understand things that aren't explicable. Like, where do ideas come from about various things? Where do people inventions come from? Where do, you know, how did human history evolve, quote unquote, the way that it has? It's, you know, there are so many mysteries that if you think that you don't know, or if you assume that you don't know, then it opens you up in a way. Like, you have to kind of empty yourself of so many conceits that, well, it's just, you know, that as human beings evolved, they became tool makers, and then they, you know, I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
there's all sorts of pontificating, but nobody really knows. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and I mean, this has become completely rampant now with sociobiology and the idea that, you know, that, well, this was a development because it conferred an evolutionary advantage and it was just another adaptation. It was like complete nonsense, you know, like, I mean, it's like, it's...
Yeah, there's, so many
like,
unknowns about
we don't even really understand ourselves, and yet, you know, it's like we're trying to explain everything, everything in the history of humanity and the universe, and you know, most people don't even know themselves. So it reveals the puniness of our knowledge. It's like that Zen story that we've told many times, but it's worth repeating about the professor who goes to meet the Zen master and asks him about the nature of Zen, and the master serves him tea, and he starts pouring the tea into the professor's cup, and it overflows, and it's overflowing, and he just keeps pouring, and the master said stop, or the professor says stop, it's overflowing, it's full, and the master says, well, you know, this is you, you know, like the cup,
you're so
full of what you think you know that you need to empty yourself in order to be able to learn Zen.
And then it's so interesting because, like, one of the teachings of Buddhism is that the essential nature of things is emptiness.
And
that's kind of what I've come to through my own explorations of consciousness. Like, somehow...
Like there's
we are like no thing, we are something that's kind of no thing, and it's because of this no thingness that it allows us to be aware of all the different things. Because I can see how I'm aware of all the different things, and none of those constitute consciousness. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is this kind of thing which allows me to be aware of things. But so the consciousness is like, it's almost like this nothingness or empty space, which allows then for me to be aware of these things. Or light. Like, and I see it as a conjunction of light within empty space. That's kind of how I understand the mystical nature of consciousness. It's like Crowley has his symbol of a point source, hadit, a point of supernal light, established within Nui, which is the Divine Mother, which represents space. So the Hadit and Nui is a conjunction of point source of light within the emptiness of space. And that's kind of a symbol for what the nature of consciousness is. So it's like a profound kind of metaphysical idea. Anyway, I was saying, yes, it's so interesting. And then the story about the Zen master is like, you have to empty your mind. And I think that's what started happening to both of us when we first started discovering the Gurdjieff teaching. And it was like everything we thought, like, we kind of realized how limited and superficial it was. And it kind of stripped away all the rubbish, as Gurdjieff calls it, the rubbish accumulated through centuries in human mentation, which he says is the aim of his book, is to destroy the rubbish accumulated. And I think that's what it, like, when I look back on how we're educated in the university system, is like accumulating all this rubbish, which has been perpetrated through the centuries.
To corrode without mercy.
Without mercy, he says. All the rubbish accumulated through.
It's one of the wonderful things about Beelzebub's tales to his grandson when you read it. I mean, even if you don't understand it, and you don't when you read it the first couple of times, it's just so hilarious. I mean, he's so clever in so many ways at various points in really distancing you from human beings and what it means to be human, and you have a less invested perspective in a way about human beings, and you kind of see the silliness of so much of what people you see the how inflated people are in their beliefs about their powers and their capabilities and their knowledge and their understanding, and that's, I mean, that's the real genius of this book, is that he's telling this story from the perspective of a higher intelligence, an alien intelligence, sort of looking down on these peculiar three-brained beings on the planet Earth, which is what his term for human beings, and you really get a sense of distance from human beings. It's a very interesting book that way, but it's also like it's very liberating emotionally too, because you lose your identification in some ways with about what it means to be human. I mean, that's the other thing too about what you were talking about you begin at when you first studied esotericism, you begin to understand that much of what you thought you knew and understood, you don't really know or understand at all. You've just been conditioned to believe these things and been told that this is this and this is that, but at the same time too, is that there's this emotional impact is that you become less invested or in things, and you become less identified with believing certain things, and if you can really open yourself, it's very freeing. It's an incredibly liberating emotional experience. It's something you said 2 weeks ago near the end of the program when you were talking at times that you have these experiences of kind of joy and love in opening your heart. It's like what Gurdjieff said about conscience, is that when you begin to feel conscience, it's that like a when conscience starts to develop in you, which is tied to the idea of your disidentifying with things and being less and less identified with things, a very subtle sense of joy begins to become manifest. And I think that's, you know, I think I've had definite tastes of what that means. And again, this is related to what you were speaking about earlier about the bliss sheath and the essential
consciousness.
And I think when you have these moments, you realize that this is real, that, you know, that our normal waking state and our normal identifications aren't really normal at all. Like, I mean, that there's something profoundly pathological about it all, and that if we could really be conscious, if we could really disidentify and wake up and know ourselves, that we'd have a very fundamentally different experience of ourselves and the world, and that it's, yeah, you know, that there's a sense that goes with it too, that you know, not intellectually but emotionally, that you know, you know, that you're apprehending reality and you know that you know it.
Because as states of consciousness, it's clearer.
Yes.
Like I've had periods
in
my life where I feel illumined, inwardly illumined, and like you feel it, like there's actual light. It's like, you know, it's like there's this self, luminous self within the heart. So the more we can, you know, clear the murk away that obscures that, then the more that light shines through. And, you know, at times in my life I've had periods where I've, you know, been flooded with the kind of illumination of, I mean, it's, yeah, different types of illumination. I didn't know if someone might have come in. I heard a beep again. I didn't know. Did we have anyone calling in?
Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yes, hi. This is John Francis. I've been holding for a while.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, John. Thanks for calling in. How are you?
Fine. Very good. It's such a wonderful, as usual, it's such a stimulating program, insightful. It's just wonderful. So many things I wanted to comment about and share with you. Now, one thing before I get to those points, I had missed the point where you were talking about the numerical value of Kabbalah.
Yeah.
So what was that number?
If you add up the, you know, in the Hebrew alphabet, each letter has a value.
Right.
If you add them up, it's the value of Kabbalah in Hebrew is 137.
Oh yes, okay, that's what I thought. You were
talking
about 137. That's very good. I wanted to just mention to Christopher when he talked about the physical soul and the body.
Mm-hmm.
Three dimensions or three aspects. Hello?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, hi. That's really profound, and that's something which Western religion really misses. They typically, of course, science only stops at the physical. Western religion, too often, they talk about just the physical and the soul, and they totally deny that we have a spirit.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting that Elaine Pagel, she wrote a book called Gnostic Paul, and she actually said that Paul had a category in the Greek of three types of people. Those who only knew themselves to be physical beings were called carnal, and those who knew themselves to be souls and physical were called psychics, and those who knew themselves to be spirit, soul, and body were called pneumatic.
Oh, yeah.
Universal breath.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was, they were like three different, they actually had three different stages of awareness that, you know, people would be in. And each person thought that they had the whole picture. If they were if they only were aware of the physical, that's all they would acknowledge to. And,
well, thanks for sharing that distinction. That's really interesting. John, one of the things which really helped clarify this for me, like this distinction, is the study of the secret doctrine. Because for Blavatsky, in the spiritual realm, like you have the seven luminous suns, but they're in the spiritual world, and what Blavatsky has is this character called Fohat, F-O-H-A-T. And Fohat she describes as the messenger for the intelligences, these spiritual intelligences. So these spiritual intelligences don't act directly on matter at all, but rather the intelligence and a higher ideas from the spiritual realm, these are conveyed through Fohat, who runs their errands. And Fohat is also said to be sevenfold. That Fohat has seven sons. So there are these seven Fohats. So Fohat is that which ensouls the living cosmos. And in Blavatsky, the idea, it's through the zero point center that the person is ensouled. Because above the zero point, like if you see the zero point center as like a time cone, or a light cone, it's called.
Right.
In the higher dimensions, that's a spiritual realm, and the lower is a physical, but it's through the zero-point dynamic so that the body is ensouled. So Fohat runs the errands for the seven luminous lord and runs circular errands and establishes the seven zero-point centers, because the one zero-point center is really sevenfold.
Right.
In Blavatsky, then this distinction between, you know, the spiritual above and then Fohat, which ensouls, and then the material body. So it really highlights that, because it all ties into the study of zero points, that people are ensouled through the zero point dynamics of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, John.
And,
go ahead.
And first of all, in your book, I have all your books, but where would I specifically like to find out about this, the threefold nature, and particularly the light that you, the inner light that results in the hologram? Is there one particular book that you would recommend or place in your book?
The newer version of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine that I reread the book, and I'm doing a whole new edition, which I hope will be ready in about a month. And it's really very deep. It's took on a whole new depth to that. And I'm not sure how long ago, what I've revised. Did you have a copy of the Heart Doctrine, where the discussions of Kabbalah, like there's fairly good discussions of that?
Well, all the books I have of yours sort of predate your conference up in.
Because I've revised them. You know, John, the next week my Heart Doctrine book is going to be available anywhere in the States through Amazon. So it'll just be you might want to see a newer edition of the Heart Doctrine book.
Yeah, I will do that. I'll get those books. One thing I want to, well, another point I wanted to make is, it's very interesting about this zero point. There's a quote from Meister Eckhart who says, "The eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me."
Wow. Beautiful.
So it's like it's a two-way window.
Yeah.
And some people have described this as black holes and white holes. The energy goes in and it comes out.
Well, I would say that, too. I argue that, like, a white hole is the emergence of a cosmos from a point source, whereas a black hole is the dissolution of the cosmos back into
right.
the point source. So creation is white hole and dissolution is a black hole. It's very symmetrical.
Right.
It's very beautiful. Yeah.
One thing I've been thinking about lately is, you know, at a certain stage of evolution, we seem to have lost our awareness of God because we don't see God. And we see God through the zero point. And what I'm wondering is that if we don't see God, you know, the corollary of the flip side of Meister Eckhart's quote would be that if we don't see God, maybe God doesn't see us. In other words,
wow.
our zero point within us is blocked. We don't
yeah.
see God, but God also loses awareness of us in a certain sense.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There's a discussion of that in the Bhagavad Gita, where the Krishna as a super soul is in mm-hmm. the heart, plus there's the jiva atma within the heart, the individual self. And they tell how the individual self, the jiva atma, gets enraptured by all the desires and fruits of the trees and so on.
Uh-huh.
So the jiva atma loses awareness of the super soul, but in the Gita, the super soul still maintains awareness of the individual self. It's like he looks upon him patronly, you know, as a lost son.
Yeah, but I'm wondering is grace somehow blocked because our connection, you know, through the zero point. But I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, this zero point seems to be the nexus through which grace flows and which we know God and God communicates with us. But if that's blocked
yeah.
in some way or constricted or tied in a knot, maybe that explains the human condition of suffering and so forth.
You know, there's a great Leonard Cohen line where he says, "Sometimes we forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us."
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah. I mean, I think that would be consistent in a way with what Gurdjieff talks about in terms of our being duty obligations to relieve the what he calls relieve the sorrow of our common father, and I think it's like, you know, that it's we have an obligation to help God, and in loosely translated, I think that's basically what he's saying. Through our own suffering, we do our own conscious suffering, we do relieve some of the burden for God. So I mean, in a sense, I think there's something really important in what you're saying. It's like that somehow what we do here on this plane in this world really does matter, and it has spiritual implications much greater than our own individual incarnations and lives and fates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also, Christopher, I also like to comment on what you were talking about with the Seal of Solomon, the Star of David, and the triangle pointing up and down, which I thought was very interesting. There's a quote from Jesus said, he says, "Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." And I pondered that quite a bit. And what I came to is that he's talking about the serpent is actually a metaphor for the kundalini, and the dove is the metaphor from the Holy Spirit. And the kundalini rises up from the base, and the Holy Spirit comes down from the crown, and they meet in the heart chakra.
Wow.
I've recently come across other teachers too that talk about there's an energy that moves up and there's an energy that comes down, and it meets in the heart center, in the zero point, and that's where the alchemy takes place through that meeting point.
Yeah, that's a very nice confirmatory, like it illustrates the whole, the dove and the serpent.
Yeah,
because the serpent...
Since I had that insight, I've had some other teachers that not refer to Jesus, but to say this idea that there's an upward movement and a downward movement. Most teachers I know, they either talk about the upward movement and they ignore the downward one, or some just talk about the downward one. I was wondering, why is there this contradiction? Well, it's actually both. So it's quite profound.
The way I see it, I kind of image the Star of David imposed over the human heart. And the heart then can, from the heart, the consciousness can be turned downwards or it into the, like there's three chakras below the heart chakra and three above. And most people's consciousness, their heart, is turned towards matter. So they're controlled by the three lower chakras, like money, sex, and power. Like the world elites is like money, sex, and power. And that's their realm, and they kind of don't believe in anything higher, and they are empty inside in a way. But then if you awaken in the heart, then the illumination of the self within the heart can illuminate the throat and brow and crown chakra, so you can have experiences in these higher levels.
I think your teachings also... have a bearing on the question of what is the purpose of life on Earth. I mean, there are a lot of course, material scientists say there is no purpose, and there's even certain so-called spiritual teachers that say basically there's no real purpose. But sort of an insight I've had, and I'd like to bounce it off you, is that we have essentially, ultimately there's all one, but the one divides into the many. You've heard of that, you know, often.
Yeah.
But in order to function in the spiritual realm, one needs a body for that realm, which is a light body.
Yeah.
And we get that light body by plunging our zero point into matter, and then that gives us the resistance against which to, in the struggle to overcome that matter, we have to, so to speak, explode the zero point and radiate light to get out of the matter. And that struggle, that incentive to get out of the matter, is what causes the light body to unfold from its zero point potential. And it's sort of like the Bible talks about how a seed must fall to, in order to for life, a seed must fall to the ground and die. And which I interpret that as the zero point incarnating and being thrust into the material realms, essentially becoming amnesic, and then having to struggle to come out of that. And in the process of struggling, a light body is manifested. And that, and then the result is that we then ascend to a realm of spirit where it's pure spirit, there's no duality. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but in other words, it's...
To go back, you began, John, by saying what is the purpose of life, and how I see it is very similar to what you're saying. I think I would say we have to acquire our souls. That the Gurdjieff uses the story of where the Fritz Peters. I don't know if you've ever heard this story. There was a young boy, Fritz Peters, who was living with Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff looked out in the yard, and there was a big oak tree. And he asked Fritz Peters, he says, "What's on the ground around the oak tree?" And he says, "Well, there's acorns." And then Gurdjieff asks him, "How many?" And the boy says, "Well, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of acorns." And then Gurdjieff asks him, "How many of those acorns are going to become oak trees?" And the boy says, "Well, I don't know, you know, maybe just a handful, maybe just one, maybe none." Mm-hmm. And Gurdjieff explains to Fritz Peters, he says, "Must study nature, understand nature. Most of those, you know, the acorn has the potential to become an oak tree, but most acorns don't become oak trees. They return to the ground," and he says, "become fertilizer for future possibilities." So what I see as human beings, we're nuts who could become oak trees. And that means acquiring our soul. And that's something just not given to us. There's a struggle. There's an alchemy. There's a discipline that at some point, hopefully, there's grace.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, we have to kind of climb this ladder of self-realization. We have to attain our souls. And I think for people who don't attain their souls, I mean, I believe that certain people are drawn off into the moon, where they're devoured carnivorously by the moon, or live in servitude in the psychical realm by beings in the moon. So there are worser fates for human beings. And our afterlife existence kind of depends on whether or not we attain our soul. So that's kind of how I see is the attainment of the soul.
I would agree
and
with
that's the development of the spiritual body. As you're saying, like Gurdjieff talks about accumulating higher hydrogens that crystallize and form your higher being bodies. Maybe, Jim, did you want to have 2 cents or more?
I agree with the part that we're all nuts. I like that story because it's an acorn, it's a very good example. And again, like you've talked about this before, but an acorn being, any seed being like a zero point in a sense. It's like everything is contained within it. It's this very small thing, and then it manifests through time and through certain processes. But it always requires a certain nurturance, and the possibility of it becoming what it could be. Are very remote, you know, like nature is pretty merciless that way. And I like that parable that Gurdjieff, you know, that he propounded to Fritz Peters, because I think it's actually very frightening in a way, because he's saying that, you know, there's nothing guaranteed in any of all this. It's not a very comforting story when you think about it. This fact is a very disturbing story on a certain level.
Yeah.
But it's like the reality that we're in is that, you know, you have to realize that there's nothing given in all of this, and so it is a struggle. And I mean, you see that all through nature. You know, it requires a certain amount of luck and a certain amount of will, and I'm not really sure. It's a great story, and I've thought of it many times ever since I read it. And I know you like to tell it because it's just like but nothing's wasted. I guess that's the other part that I was going to say, is that nothing's wasted in all of this in nature. Is that, you know, you go back and you
recycle.
And you recycle and you become food for something. You know, that's consistent with his idea that everything in the universe eats and is eaten. So, you know, you become food for something. It's just what kind of food are you going to become?
Yeah, and Gurdjieff says that when a person dies, their soul, certain energies associated with the life in the body, feeds the moon. So that the soul feeds the moon. So what we want to do in Gurdjieff teaching is we want to feed the sun, because the sun is related to our spiritual body. And then the divine world is related to the starry world. So we have these higher, our spiritual body then is connected to the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important in the discussion to distinguish between soul, the psychic level, and the spiritual level. I'm just going to limit it to three. And, you know, because I think that there is, you know, you talk about the soul, food for something else. Well, then we have to be careful how we use these terms, because I think that there's also the zero point is a nucleus that never is destroyed. It's beyond space and time.
Yeah.
So I could see how you could have a sort of an arrested development where the light body temporarily doesn't manifest. But I don't, this idea of being eaten or dissolving, I mean, I think there's a nucleus that's eternal and immortal.
Yeah.
And so I would be careful to.
One way Gurdjieff explains that is he says, like, even these souls who are kind of drawn in into the lower worlds, they'll still have other opportunities to evolve. But he says the evolution of these souls takes place over the time period of the evolution of the solar system.
Right.
Okay, so that's over like millions and billions of years. So, you know, whereas an individual can make higher attainments in this life now, you know, and in a way that, yes, like as you're saying, the monadic essence in each person, the God spark, never dies.
Yeah.
But that person can go on a long sojourn in lost in different lower worlds and further and further away from the light. But over huge periods of time, that person still has that potential for evolution. And,
right,
and Blavatsky would say before the end of the seventh round that all these souls will have attained to these higher levels. I guess that's why the bodhisattvas come back to, as teachers, kind of to bring humankind along.
Would you relate this to what Carl Jung calls individuation? The idea that we're sort of all in the oneness or the plenum, and as monads, there's really only one monad, but, you know, holographically appearing as many in the plenum, and that this plunging into the material world is for the process of individuation, for unfolding our potential from the zero point and manifesting a light body.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the term individuation. It's like a part of God which kind of loses itself and is sewn into matter and then rediscovers its own origins. And that's
right.
And then it's has the same potency, but it's awakened in it, so it's individuated.
Right. Yeah, Jesus tells a parable of people that were invited to a wedding feast, and someone tried to show up without the proper wedding garment and was cast back out into where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. In other words, the idea that you need a certain vehicle or garment in order to function in the kingdom of heaven, the higher realms.
Yeah, it's like he hadn't attained his light body.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's another parable of the prodigal son who goes off. I'm sure you've heard of it. There's also similar parables in the East of wandering off and then coming back home. And the prodigal son, what his reward is from going through all his sufferings in the outer worlds is he gets the king, the father gives the prodigal son his finest robe, puts the king, the father puts his finest robe on the son. So that's also symbolic to me of the light body. In other words, what's the purpose of all this journeying down here through matter? It's to cultivate something within of a spiritual essence. So I think I want to thank you. I'll let you go on and talk some more because you have so much wisdom.
Well, hold on, John, just a moment. You have a very valuable book. I'm trying to. It's Radiant.
It's called The Mystic Way of Radiant Love.
And is that available? How could people get a copy?
Well, it's quickly going out of print. Basically, I was going to mention, I'm going to be giving a lecture this coming Friday, March 12th, in Monterey, California, at the Illuminata Bookstore.
Oh.
So I don't know if you have any listeners in the Monterey area, but I'll be there at 7:30, a free lecture. I'll have some of my books there. But I'm quickly running out, and I'm going to have to working on another book next year. But I guess
Still
have a link up. You still have a link on your website, I think, too, don't you?
I incorporated elements from your book into my own book, The Heart Doctrine. Your commentary on The Heart Doctrine on the back cover of my book when it's being published, John.
I'm definitely going to run out and get it now. That's wonderful because, I mean, all your work really has been very valuable to me because a lot of my work has come from my own inner experience and decoding the Bible and the more traditional saints, you know, in the Eastern Church and some but I was never too familiar with Blavatsky's work and the line of work that you're talking about. So it's really nice to have developed something, you know, sort of on my own, so to speak, with other sources, and then suddenly finding a whole body of other knowledge that supports it, it's very empowering. So what you've done has really been very helpful to me.
And I really valued your work because I had come to this zero-point understanding through other areas of study, and then I found that you had embodied this, you had come to this from a Christian perspective, and you had a lot of valuable material in your book, which I would strongly recommend to people.
Yeah, so I think the work you're doing is really important because it has strong implications for science and physics and spirituality and, you know, our society. And it's just a matter of communicating this to the public in a way that they can relate to. I think that's the challenge. Okay.
I'm hoping within 3 months I'm going to have these two most important of my books in paperback, and then I hope to try to go more public and be on different radio shows again to try to promote my books.
Yeah.
And you know, I hope that's coming up, John.
Yeah, you know, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of programs where you could do this, and I think the thing is, it has to be made in a way that people can relate to, you know, and that's the challenge. The way we're talking between us, I mean, we have a common understanding and vocabulary, but it has to be broken down, I think, even more to people's everyday life. And what happens when we pass on and this and that. So I'm sure you're going to do that. But
That's volume 3 of the Within Without series is on the multidimensional universe and afterlife states and things.
Yeah. I think one thing that's happening that I want to mention, I think we're living in a particularly important time. I think there are certain times and certain ages and cycles where there are special graces that come down for those who are ready to, you know, to manifest this light body, let's just say. And it's really important that people, knowledge can be very helpful, because when we have knowledge of who we are and why we're here, we can align our individual intentions with a larger cosmic intention that's at work. And I think that facilitates the process. It's not something that happens by accident. You know, there are a lot of New Age teachers that say, oh, you could just, you know, something's going to happen. We're all going to be changed. We're all going to become enlightened. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to meditate. You don't have to know anything. You just go about your business, sit on your TV, couch and watch your TV, and we're all going to become enlightened. But doesn't work that way, I don't think.
No, I definitely agree it doesn't. And we are in a very significant, interesting time, as the Chinese proverb says.
Yeah.
I mean, we're kind of in a situation in the world where I think around the world people are waking up to the kind of criminality that's been going on in our societies for decades and centuries. And we're kind of waking up to this, really what's been done to humankind. You know, I believe that, like, humankind's been intentionally dummied down with things like the theory of evolution, which I believe was a fraud, and the suppression of all the evidences for paranormal and mystical and psychical phenomena. And I think we've been dummied down in the religions. Hardly anyone in the religions has any understanding of the esoteric teachings of their own religion. That's what I find. Like, how many Christians have any concept of the law of seven? And yet it's inherent to Christianity and Judaism.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've tried to reconcile this in my mind, and, you know, this polarity of good and evil. And the way I've been able to do it without getting caught in the polarity itself is to understand that this, what we call negative or this oppositionist darkness, actually serves a higher purpose, in that it provides the resistance against which when we struggle against it, it essentially forces us to increase our light, our illumination. In other words, in order to overcome this darkness and this deception and all the oppression, exploitation, the only way it can really be done is through light, increasing our light. So it gives us, you know, it's sort of like building a muscle. How do you build a muscle except by moving against resistance, you know, of a weight?
Yeah.
And so I try and see it from that non-dualistic point of view, that it actually, from a higher point of view, is serving a purpose, providing the challenges to overcome, to grow. And, of course, the people doing this in the dark don't think this way. They don't think that they're helping us grow spiritually. But by overcoming, maybe that's why Jesus said, love your enemies. I don't think he meant, you know, go along with what they're doing. But by hating them, you just helpful victim to them, but by understanding they serve a purpose, one can be detached from them and rise above them, if you know what I this is being
yeah.
clear.
I mean, it's like if you didn't have bad guys, you couldn't have the Lord of the Rings tale. I mean, there'd just be no story. All the hobbits would have just stayed home and watched TV.
Yeah,
so
but
in a way, you know, God's story.
Yeah, there'd be no incentive to grow either. I mean, when things are kind of sweet and gentle and nice on Earth, people would just be content to live a very simple, mundane life of TV and recreation and so forth. But when the rug is pulled out from under us, it really forces us to ask deep questions. Why are we here? And so I
yeah.
think that a lot of people, I mean, that's sort of the way I see it. I think it also will, people that aren't ready for this evolution, they'll be sort of shunted to the side by some deception or some lesser, you know, enticement. So it's like, I think of it as an automobile. An automobile has a brake and an accelerator. And I think of the accelerator as the, you know, sort of the forces of light that move us forward in evolution. And the brake is there.
Resistance, yeah.
Yeah, that resistance. So I think there is a, you know, the whole issue, idea of matter, what's the purpose of coming into this matter? I've sort of come to this conclusion that I don't see it as having a purpose, but nonetheless, I don't, you know, wallow in it or condone it.
It's amazing. I look at what's happening in the world, and I think, my God, what an incredible story. How could,
right.
unbelievable, like around the world, we have all these psychopaths, perverts, and pedophiles who kind of completely took over our nations and infiltrated everything and did all these insane things, like chemtrailing people and everything.
Right.
How did that happen to us? It's like in the Bible, it says, while we were sleeping, a thief came
right.
and stole it all away. And that's what humankind, we've been sleeping. You know,
and it's
like we as humankind, we need to experience what Gurdjieff calls a remorse of conscience. Like,
right.
hey, United States of America, you know, you've just murdered 2 million people in the Middle East, all based on lies for these
right.
psychopaths. You know,
right.
it's incredible. And
yeah.
what's happening in the world makes any novel or any story anyone has ever written look puny. Like
yeah.
it's like God's stories being acted
yeah.
out, and as you say, John, you know that the forces of evil have their role. I mean, they're part of this cosmic play.
Yeah, and actually, they're really doomed to failure because the more suffering they create, the more it's going to wake people up. I mean, ultimately, because it's and the more it will encourage people to you know overcome. So it's sort of like it's doomed to failure. It's doomed to failure, and the forces of light are doomed to succeed, because the more suffering that they create, eventually people will wake up because of that, and there'll be a counter to it. And it's interesting that, too. It says in the Bible that we're living in a dark age. They call it Kali Yuga or whatever.
Yeah.
So this is everything that we're seeing has all been predicted. I mean, it's all cyclical. It's all in the scriptures.
Yeah.
And in the Bible, it even says that at the end of the age, that all secrets will be made known. In other words, there's a light shining down. It's going to expose everything. The work that you're doing now and many other people that are exposing all of this, you know, that 10 years ago we didn't even think about.
No.
This is part of something cosmic, that there is actually a light and a conscious light that's waking people up and allowing them to see things that they didn't ever saw before. And I think this is all a very hopeful sign that we're on the cusp of a golden age, and all this struggling and suffering and revelations about what's going on is exactly what we would expect if we were to be going from a state of being asleep and amnesic to
yeah.
an awakened golden age. So exactly what's happening now is, although it's so much crisis and struggle and whatever, is exactly what we'd expect if we were going to be moving into a golden age.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So it's wonderful. Maybe I guess you want to start wrapping things up, but
Jim, no. Say you can stay with us a little while more, John. Jim,
sure. Yeah, I have no problem. Yeah. I don't want to hog the phone, but
yeah, no. I was just going to give Jim a bit of time, space.
Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead. I don't have anything to say. I'm just listening. It's very interesting.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's a time, like, what is important in this, in our times, to me, is we have to attain our souls. Like, I see more and more people around who are soulless. It's like they're empty inside.
Uh-huh.
And they become more and more like automatons.
Uh-huh.
I notice that at times I go outside and I'll look in the sky. Lately we've been heavily chemtrailed all over the sky in Kemptville. And I go out and everybody kind of walks down the street. Nobody ever looks up. Nobody wonders, like, doesn't it make you wonder why people are spraying you with all this white stuff and what that's about? And it's like everybody's like so asleep, you know, thinking about the baseball game or the hockey game or something. They're so lost.
Yeah.
It's like,
I think what most people do is they've sort of surrendered their responsibility to various authority figures. There's somebody taking care of the weather. There's someone taking care of religion. There's someone taking care of this. And it's like we've given up our individual responsibilities. A lot of people have. And I think it's part of it's also the Stockholm syndrome, if you're aware of that.
Where you come to love your captors or oppressors.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's exactly, and you see that all the time. One other thing I wanted to mention that's important at this time, I think, is forming community and finding one's spiritual family. I think that's very important, not to become isolated, but to find those people that we know we resonate with, that are on our particular path or we feel a spiritual kinship with.
Yeah.
And begin to talk to each other and form little groups and so forth. I think this is very important not to be isolated. I think the isolation has been part of the agenda to keep people disempowered. What do you think about that?
Well, I absolutely agree with both aspects. I think people have become more and more isolated, and I think there's nothing more isolating than the TV, which has been the biggest curse upon humankind. I lost a little bit.
I guess I'm just in my mind is how do we reestablish community where we live in, you know, we live in a situation where we don't even know who our next door neighbors are and we don't want to talk to them. And it's been quite how do we get this way?
I mean, I think we need to be building community, everything from gardening locally and being out more and organizing at community levels, like people to organize resistance against aspects of the New World Order system as they're being brought in. And I think we need to be in community. It's for support when people wake up and realize what's happening. I think, as you say, I think it's really important we get back into our community and, you know, like the traditional American values, you know, your community and supporting people locally and growing locally. And, you know, we can't trust the food supply now with what's being done and, you know, and medicines. You can't just kind of give your fate over to the doctors, all controlled by the pharmaceutical mafia and, we have to take responsibility for ourselves and get back to nature, get back to community, local sustainable economy and development. All of these things are very important. Yes, Jim,
maybe that's why the system is breaking, will fall apart around us, is to move us in that direction.
Well, I think one of the things that I think maybe that John was alluding to is about spiritual community is that you know, this is very important, and that I think that's a very difficult one, but I mean I think that's very important is that you have to give to others in order to it's not just an individual. It's not just an individual aim in terms of developing consciousness and spirit. It isn't solely an individual undertaking. Within the fourth way, they always say that things are done for yourself, for others, and for the work itself, like for the bigger purpose of things. And I think that the more you give to others, the more you take. It's law conformable in that sense, and that really applies, I think, to any kind of spiritual development. You have to give to others in order to progress yourself, and so by definition, then you have to be with other people, and you have to strive to serve other people. I think the whole idea of service is another really important concept in spiritual growth and spiritual development and the development of consciousness. And I think that's what a lot of people don't get from traditional religious communities and religious services, is that sense of community isn't as strong as perhaps they'd like. I mean, conversely, I think that is what some people get from traditional religious services and institutions, is that they do find the community, and so that's good for them, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's funny, I would say, I think that's what people have found more in the churches than they found the like true esoteric teaching of that religion. That's been part of the problem, is that churches and that have become social things more so than spiritual communities. I guess to have the spiritual community aspect, you have to have some spiritual teachings.
So it seems to be a balance. In other words, most people are, in terms of, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, people are looking for survival and belongingness, and they stop right there, you know, because the churches can provide that with pancake breakfasts and networking for jobs and this and that. But there is no the vision of the transcendent vision is lost of what the higher purpose of religion is. So. It does fulfill the need for belongingness and some security needs.
And it's so tragic, like what's become of the churches. Like you look at the Catholic Church through the centuries, I would say it's the synagogue of Satan. You know, that we've accepted these false teachings and. I don't think people don't really have a sense of the corruption of their own churches and how rampant that is. And
well, they don't want to know. They're in denial too, because I think a lot of people are just they're threatened by real spirituality, because that requires growth and change, and so basically they get what they want, in a sense. It sort of reminds me of these mega churches that I was reading in the paper, how they close down on Christmas Day because they say, well, people are too busy doing other things for their family.
Wow.
The mega churches close on Christmas because, people have all their other social things that are going on. So in other words, their social function, their social needs are met in other ways on that day, so they don't need church.
Sad.
One of the things that Jacob Needleman wrote a very good book called The New Religions in the early 1970s. And what he was talking about in that was how young people in the Western world were turning to Eastern spiritual teachings and traditions. And he said he felt that one of the main reasons why there was such appeal to Western youth in these teachings, and people were turning away from their own religion to exploring these other paths, was because he said in the Western religions, the instrumental aspect of religion, the instrumental aspects of the teachings have been lost, and by contrast, the Eastern teachings seem to have a much more vibrant and much more practical, instrumental aspect was still alive in their teachings, and that's what people were searching for. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about, Chris, about the esoteric.
Yeah.
People don't even know the esoteric aspects of their own teachings, because there isn't really much of an instrumental teaching other than sort of the rote practice of prayer and, you know, the going through the motions kind of in terms of the rituals in church. But people don't really understand that they're meant to engender states of consciousness, or that they're meant to help us achieve states of consciousness. All that's kind of lost, and it's what John was saying earlier about you turn authority over for certain aspects of your life to the acknowledged experts. So you turn religion over to the priests and the ministers, and you know, you turn things over to the government, you turn other things over to the businesses, and people don't want to take responsibility for really the making of their own souls, that idea is just so foreign to us that you have any kind of responsibility, spiritual responsibility. But and that's really at the heart of the problem, I think, is that has been lost, you know, and that people are lost in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's why I think that there are pretty dramatic karmic consequences coming down upon us as a peoples to have allowed the extent of this corruption in our countries and throughout the world. I mean, you just look at the tragedies of what is happening around the world now. Like, we have a world aflame with, like, wars and conflict and hatreds and police state and poison in every possible way. I mean, it's just incredible. It's like the karma is coming down upon the people. You know, we didn't defend our countries. You know, we were so busy watching the football game that, you know, where are the Christians? You know, why did the Christians support a war that's murdered 2 million innocent people? You know, and this has been allowed to go on, and the extent of the corruption in our societies, it's truly tragic. It's like humankind never had sane, compassionate leadership. You know, we had no chance in a way, you know, and we were all born into it because the basic designs of this whole thing, like, they predate us. I only woke up to it 3 years ago, you know, but we've probably been part of it through history too in our previous lives. That's what I feel.
Well, I think the times we're living in now are very, very similar to the times that were 2,000 years ago when Jesus came. You know, you can draw parallels between the Roman Empire and the empires we see now.
Oh, yeah.
And how they would go into other countries, extract their resources, bring them back into Rome, you know, for the benefit of a very relative few people. And it was sort of in that situation that, you know, that Jesus came, and what he did was he did two things. One, he brought a spiritual power, the Holy Spirit, where he knighted people, you know, spiritually initiated them, and they became healers and whatever. And they also formed small communities, and they were consequently persecuted by the empire. But I think there are very, very strong parallels. And what's ironic is that the church, after a few centuries, it became Romanized, so it became essentially co-opted.
Yeah.
So
okay, well, we're coming down to our last few minutes, so we'll let you go, John. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. And
calling
if anyone wants to see me in Monterey, I'll be at the Luminata bookstore this Friday the 12th at 7:30.
Great.
Okay, cool.
You're out there. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, John.
Thanks, John.
Yes, nice to hear from John. I met John. Unfortunately, I didn't have much time to talk with him, but when I was at the IONS Institute in California.
Oh, yeah. Is he based in California?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got just about 5 minutes. I'll remind people, my website is at zeropoint.ca, and I will put an announcement up there when my Heart Doctrine book is available in trade paperback, which I'm looking forward to this week, And I'm having a fascinating time redoing this Secret Doctrine book, Jim. It's just going to be even stronger than it was before. I've had some quite illuminating moments and periods in the last few weeks as I've restudied it again and revised it. Some beautiful new sections to the book.
I told you I just reread it. I just recently.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
I think in the last section, I just would make one comment to you. In the last section, I think you kind of wander around a little bit because I think you kind of repeat yourself on a lot of things. I think you need to kind of look at that and sort of tighten that up a little bit. But I was really impressed by it. I thought it was very, very good. And overall, I thought it was really, you know, I mean, well, there's just so much in it. It's a lot to digest. It's like, I mean,
it is.
And what John was saying about bringing it to people on a certain level, I mean, I don't think your work really does do that, and it can do that in a way because it's so, there's so many aspects to it. It's intellectually, it's challenging, and it's so profound. But at the same time, I think you do try to address that, like, and say, like, this is important, you know, and if you can try to understand this, you know, through your own efforts, even though you can't sort of grasp it all at one time, but this is important to people, and we need to try to understand these things because it gives a very different sense of what the meaning of our lives is and what our responsibilities are and what our priorities should be. So it's certainly worth trying to do your best to understand it, but it's not going to be something that you're going to grasp in a day or two. I mean, I think in some senses the Heart Doctrine is more accessible than God Science and the Secret Doctrine, because I think it's not easy, but I think it's a little bit more easier to relate to for most people
And I think it develops the argument and the analysis from first principles in a way.
Well,
like,
exactly,
you don't have
to
have a background in anything to read
it.
No, I think that book is more approachable, even though the practical psychology of it isn't there.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what do you do? That's why the next book I'm going to try to prepare for publication, it will be Psychological Illusions, eh? Because that book on the Gurdjieff teaching is the most practical and valuable book I've produced, I would say.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most practical. Like, if you ask, well, what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, learn self-remembering, learn an understanding of the centers, you know. These are profoundly valuable teachings.
Yeah, there aren't many really good books, I don't think, that have been written in the last 40 years on Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way. I think your book is really, really good. I think my book is good too, on an alien intelligence. But I think your book, Psychological Illusions, is very comprehensive, probably more comprehensive than anything that I can think of in terms of, like, it really covers a huge amount of material and provides a really interesting insight because you are a psychologist, which is, you know, most of the people who have written. I didn't like Charles Tart's book, Waking Up,
on the Fourth Way,
and I like Charles Tart a lot, but I wasn't impressed by his book at all. And other than Charles Tart, I can't think of another psychologist offhand who's written about a book about the Fourth Way or about Gurdjieff. So, which is in and of itself is an interesting statement. You know, when you think about it, it's very peculiar.
Okay, well, we'll be back in 2 weeks, Jim. Thanks for your contribution. I'll keep you informed when I decide to have our opening up here in Ottawa.
Yeah, let me know when.
I'm going to send you a copy of the what's it called? The proof copy. I ordered five copies.
The galleys?
As soon as if I have a look at it and it's approved, all I can just do it over the internet and it's done. It's available.
Okay.
And then I can even order bulk copies myself.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's quite exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. That's great.
Okay, so we'd like to thank BBS Radio. This has been Zero Point Talk Show. Please visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca.
Yeah.
Okay, keep heart. Let's remember ourselves and try to get back and regain our essential consciousness. Okay, goodbye.
Bye.